just Google Spectrum Thin Film plus Long Island. You'll eventually get to Tony. He's moved into a new location that's either 10 or 15,000 square feet. He's located in Hop-Hog, and he coated the lenses that are going to be on that spacecraft that's landing on Mars in a couple of weeks, Paul. So a piece of Long Island, you could say, is landing on Mars. Newsday yesterday has an article about it. His website will tell you more. And so we've got a piece of the action. When it comes to this failure of a circuit breaker that maybe occurred on Apollo 11 that Eugene is bringing to our attention, I know that AIL, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, which at the time was owned by Cutler Hammer, Cutler Hammer was bragging about the fact that they supplied many, if not all, of the circuit breakers that were used on Apollo 11. So I'm overly curious as to whether or not the failed circuit breaker was it a Cutler Hammer brand name. When you guys find out about it, I'd like to know. That was the company that used to own the company that I worked for. Back to you, Paul, from the S2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. I'll have to read up a little bit more on that. I know it was a breaker that wouldn't hold, and they just held it in with their pen. I think I've heard not Armstrong talk about it, but Aldrin. That's probably where I've heard it. He does interviews. And, stand by. Okay, and then, what else? Oh, the article, yeah, the company in Hop-Hog, yeah, I did see that article. And he's done other work for NASA and for the military. So that's very good for Long Island. And the mirrors on the VLT is a very large telescope, four of them. It was definitely cast as one big piece. They went in depth their explanation on the show I saw. And they showed these things spinning, being heated. And then I forget how many, a couple, 4 months or something to cool down. I mean, it just like took forever. And they showed one by one, they would pack them up, and they would put them on a cargo ship. It'd take a couple of months to float from, where were they being made? I believe they were being made in Germany, if I'm not mistaken, but in Europe somewhere. And then they float them off to Chile, take many months to get there, and then put them in a gigantic, specially built truck, and take, I think, 3 days to go 100 miles into the desert to the site. They would go no more than 2 or 3 miles an hour with these trucks and drop it. They would send out bulldozers and everything in front of it because the roads really aren't that good out there going up to the site. They would send out bulldozers to flatten things, everything nice and smooth for this truck with this gigantic mirror to get to the site. And they even mentioned, well, it's a good time when one of these mirrors come up because they can fly back and forth in their truck when they do have to go to the town 100 some odd miles away. Because after a while the road becomes rough again. So it came time for another mirror, a month later or two. Show up, it would smooth everything out again. So yeah, there's definitely four individual mirrors, but they're able to flex. They're thin. They showed how thin they were. They're able to flex, so they're able to actually, bend and lift one side and drop the other side, or bend or twist these mirrors. And that's their idea of the adaptive optics. It's definitely different than the Keck design. I know what you mean with the 36 individual mirrors. This is one big mirror, and then, well, actually, there's four of them, and then they went put together. Back to you, except you asked.
Now, I think you were also asking a question of how they integrate the picture. When it comes to astrophotography and the disturbance you get from the atmosphere and the periodic really good look you get, if you're running the equivalent of a motion picture, but it's really charged-coupled device, a focal plane array, really sensitive pixels, and you run a continuous film, you run a continuous motion picture, so to speak. And when you play it back during processing, you select the good frames and throw out the bad frames and properly register them and lay them on top of each other to integrate the picture. You can take a long time exposure and get extreme sensitivity when you do that. I believe it was the telescope you're talking about right now, which was in a story about the European Southern Observatory of about 6 months ago, where they had taken the dimmest picture mankind had ever made up till that time. Each astronomical magnitude is such that 5 magnitudes is a 100-to-1 ratio in brightness of a star. And so the human eye, the brightest star in the sky you can see is around magnitude 0. Positive numbers are dimmer objects. The human eye can see something like magnitude 6 or 7. A good telescope with an 8-inch diameter can see something like magnitude 13. Mount Palomar under normal conditions can see something like, I think it's magnitude 21. Well, they decided to look at what Halley's Comet looks like now that it's at its aphelion. In other words, it's the furthest distance from the sun. Halley's Comet is, when it drops, as black as a piece of coal. It's not very big, and it's extremely far away. I forget how many times it is further away than Pluto, but it's really far away. Small object, dark object, far away from the sun. And they managed to take a picture of Halley's Comet at its aphelion, I guess it is. Apocynthian, aphelion, the furthest possible distance it gets from the sun. And that was something like magnitude 28.5. In order to do that, they were gathering 1 photon per second and a half into this huge telescope on top of this mountain in Chile, which is really a desert area, 10,000 feet up. Takes a long time to get there. Manfred drives there. It takes him most of the day to drive to his place of work, and he stays there for a week and a half and then goes home for a week to be off. You can't drive home each day because it's such rough terrain and such a high mountain under such a switchback road. And so they had to pull those mirrors up that particular road in La Salina, Chile. No easy task. What was I starting to say? When they took that picture of Halley's Comet, and by the way, as you've heard me say before, Halley has got at least 3 pronunciations. Most people call it Halley's Comet. Most of the astronomers call it Halley's Comet. But the family name is Holy. It's really Holy's Comet. Anyhow, that particular comet, they took a picture of it, and I think they had to integrate the picture for like 24 hours, a time exposure. They were gathering 1 photon per second into this huge mirror because that comet was so dim and so far away from the sun and so far away from us. And so that, to my knowledge, is the dimmest object that has ever been photographed. And not only did you have to lay a whole lot of individual frames of the motion picture on top of each other to integrate the coherent signals you get from the comet versus the random noise, they also had to subtract out sky brilliance from, even though they're in one of the darkest places in the world, on top of this mountain in a very rural area of Chile in the Andes Mountains, still they had to use a whole lot of subtraction technique to get rid of the atmospheric stray light that was there. Quite a project. When you go to the European Southern Observatory, just Google those words, you'll find some very interesting things that they're continuously doing. They're making some great breakthroughs. They've discovered quite a number of the exoplanets. In other words, the planets that are going around stars that are far removed from our particular sun. I think we're up to something like 250 planets have been discovered that are not in our particular solar system. So that number is continuously increasing. And as they increase, it's repeated. As they increase the sensitivity of the hardware they're using, they're starting to find smaller and smaller planets. Up till now, they've been finding Jupiter-sized planets because that's the easiest thing to find with the instrumentation they've been using. They're going to start finding the smaller ones, the Earth-sized ones, and I'm rather sure they're there. So a big QSO in the sky. Is that going to take place in our lifetime? Interesting thing to speculate about. Back to you, Paul, for any other comments. WS2N, KQRAW in the SECNAT.
Ah, very good, Dick. Very, very good. I was just wondering about the radio astronomy. I assume that's done similar when you see 20 or 30 dishes lined up. I would imagine they're taking their information and overlapping or overlaying it, similar to what they're doing with the optics. I have to assume that's it, right? Back to you.
Yes and no. In the case of the optics, you get a little bit of increase in resolution because of the spacing between the telescopes. You get a hell of a lot more light gathering power because you can add up all of the brilliance you get from each of the four telescopes. In the case of a radio telescope, the thing you're lacking most is not effective capture area. The thing you're lacking most is resolution. Once you fix the size of your optical telescope or radio telescope, the thing that determines how sharp an angle you can see, what your resolving power is how many wavelengths of diameter is your receiving aperture. Well, because the optical frequency range is a million times higher than 600 megacycles, you could say you get a million times more resolution out of an optical telescope than you do out of a radio telescope. Rough rule of thumb. As such, in order to make a sharp picture with a radio telescope, you need a lot of area. And therefore, you need a lot of diameter of the receiving aperture. So the modern technique for doing that is like the very large array in Socorro, New Mexico. It consists of, I think it's 27 individual dishes that are each something like 90 feet in diameter, and they're in a great big Y pattern, in the usual way they arrange them. By properly phasing those, you can electronically steer the beam into the direction you care about. You steer each individual dish into the general area. But the real steering of the beam is the way you phase, the way you combine the 27 signals. And the nice thing about that kind of a radio telescope is that if you've got 27 individual recordings on a high-speed tape recorder of what each one of the 27 dishes sees, you can then take those 27 recordings, combine them in various ways. You can combine them so that they all look at the picture that is broadside to the very large array. Or you can combine them with a little bit of phase shift so you're steering a little bit off to one side. You can get a whole lot of individual pictures out of one recording out of those 29 dishes. You can steer the beam electronically after the fact. That's kind of cute. Now when it comes to very long baseline interferometry, that's where you've got a dish in Madrid, Spain, you've got one in Honeysuckle Creek, Australia, you've got one at Goldstone, California, you've got one at Arecibo, Puerto Rico. You put all of those dishes together, and now you're using something that has the resolution property of a antenna that is close to the diameter of the Earth. Gives you very sharp resolution. Not quite the light gathering power, but at least the resolution is something.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In the case of radio astronomy, you lack resolving power a lot more than you lack effective capture area for brilliance of the signal, so to speak. Particularly if you're using modern day good low noise amplifiers. You got enough signal, you just don't have the resolving power to look at the fine details of those things in space. So interferometry is heavily used in radio telescopes. It's just starting to be used with optical telescopes, with things like the very large telescope you're describing in Chile. Back to you, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW.
UKEY, why would a comment?
Very good explanation, Dick. And yeah, I hear Mel in there. Very good, Dick. Yeah, that's what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear the comparison. I hear Mel. Good evening, Mel, WS.
Good evening, Paul. This is K2KEY. What I was going to bring up wasn't the FCPI, the SETI project. They were going to get a bunch of amateur astronomers with their own antennas and link them together via a central computer system and see if they can continue the project, in other words, to get, like Dick says, this very large diameter dish to be used for this project is not practical because I guess the project is more or less been abandoned. Now to take it over by amateurs, I understand that's basically what they're going to do, try to combine a lot of individual dishes in researching this project. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
Yeah, for quite a number of years, I was a member of SARA, Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, and they would hold their yearly meeting at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. One of the SARA members is Paul Shook. I think his call letter is N6TX, but I'm not positive of Paul's call letters. And Paul is the leader of a group that's called the SETI League, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence League. And he publishes a monthly newspaper, he's got membership, and he has arranged in one of his backyards a significant number of satellite receiving dishes, the 12-foot diameter type thing. So he's setting up a small radio telescope, small by international standards, in his backyard, and he's also trying to assemble smart people around the world to join him with very long baseline interferometry. That was his goal. I don't know how well it is going, but it's a pretty lofty goal because the SETI searches have essentially been abandoned. So the funding from National Science Foundation has been abandoned at most of the major sites. Some SETI searches are still taking place. Let me drop. What each radio astronomer does is when he gathers the data for his particular project that is funded by the NSF, if there's a possibility that he could look at the data again in a different way and do a SETI search, quite a few of them are doing that. But if you do a direct proposal for a SETI search and expect NSF funding, most likely you will not get it. And so that's the sad state of affairs there. And so various proposals of the SETI League and also the SETI Institute, a group in California, headed up by Jill Potter, I think it is. They're trying to assemble volunteers to make a search for extraterrestrial telescope by combining the signals from a whole lot of guys' backyards. It's a lofty project. I don't think it has come off yet, but maybe it will. I'll turn it back to you, Mel, and maybe we should start thinking into the mailbag so people don't get angry at us. K2KEY.
And WS2N, there's one other guy, Dick, that's doing this, too.
Who is that, Paul?
A guy named Paul Allen. He was one of the founders of Microsoft. He's got, I don't know how many millions of dollars invested into dozens of these antennas. I've seen that, pictures of that site. And he's involved with the Planetary Society. One of the founders of the Planetary Society was Carl Sagan. That group is still active, and they're always pushing for guys to invest in this type of thing. And so Paul Allen has got, I don't know how many millions involved. Yeah, I forgot what it was, 100 million, whatever. Big money. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the reason why we haven't detected these extraterrestrial intelligence beings yet is because they don't want to be detected. I'm only half kidding when I say that. I mean, it's a pretty good science fiction and maybe a science fact when you watch Star Trek and they talk about the Prime Directive. In other words, don't interfere with another society. You might destabilize them. There's a slim possibility that that is taking place. K2KDY, I wonder if you've heard some strange signals from time to time, Mel. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Some of my contacts, I think, were very suspicious where they were or what they were. Anyhow, yeah, I used to get Paul Such, Dr. Such's back. Oh, I don't want to get into the whole thing. I met him down in Florida. I was down in Florida one time, and they had a convention down there. And I met him, and he was playing a guitar and the whole thing and telling the whole story, and I got the whole conversation with him about when I was at the University of Ohio and the VBLI system that they had there that took up a whole field, you know, a whole football field, and what became a football field. But at that time, you know, John Krause was there. And, it was quite a, you know, quite a thing. But they were very, you know, that was really the epitome of searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. Was the fact that the famous WOW signal was received there. Dick, over.
Yeah, I was at the NRAO, National Radio Astronomy Observatory, in which Paul Shook gave us a presentation about the WOW signal, and he sung his song about astronomy on his guitar. He has, from time to time, given that speech at Dayton, and the guys at Dayton, and also I think he gave it once at the microwave update in Dallas, Texas. The guys in Dallas, Texas told Paul that if he sings that song during his presentation, they will yank him off the stage unceremoniously. So people who have heard that song and think that Paul is a little bit disillusioned, that he is not a good minstrel singer. For people who don't like that particular guitar song of Paul's. Other than that, most of his motivations are, let's say, interesting. If you ever go to Paul's website, he has a website that goes on for about 5 pages, just listing every single article he has ever written, every patent he has ever applied for, every presentation he has ever made, every course he has ever taken. I mean, my goodness, is he documented. Wow. Interesting character. But, so, you've met Paul. You and I have both met Paul. I gave Paul some of my physics puzzles. And the lady he was with at the time, 6 months later, divorced him. There could be no connection. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's 2NYW. He was a, let's put it this way, somewhat far out, because before your words came out of your mouth, you had an answer or anything. I mean, it just was nothing. It just stuck there. You think this guy would be looking for throwing things out of left and right and all. And he got into a whole, you know, I could say, dissertation on it with his car and all, but he got into this thing with the so-called water hole, the WOW signal, and it went on, and he was like, I don't know how to describe it, but they're out there, you know, he started with, they're out there, we just got to, you know, pick up the signal, and I think people were thinking that this guy, he's a very, very bright guy, no doubt, it's basically a genius, but slightly, you know, off-center a little bit, Dick, because that's the only way I can say it. I enjoyed being, you know, there and talking to him and everything like that, but you got to be careful getting involved in this kind of conversation. And when I brought up that business of, you know, researching for extraterrestrial intelligence in the so-called water hole, that was the, I can say, that started really a whole constant dissertation on that for about, I'd say, 35, 40 minutes without taking a breath over.
Yeah, and the main frequency of operation of the big ear, the Ohio, Miamisburg, Ohio radio telescope, that great big tiltable flat dish thing into a parabolic surface invented by Dr. John Krause. Unfortunately, they had to take it apart. It lost its funding, but a beautiful piece of equipment that didn't pick up the WOW signal. Ed, N2, I think it was NYW. I think you want to make a comment? Go right ahead, Ed.
Good evening. Now, I want to know about the, I was reading somewhere online, so remember the Drake equation? How they used to, you know, talk about that all the time? They seem to want it discounted now, saying that that's not really, that it really doesn't make much sense anymore the way things are today. Over.
There's multiple ways of looking at that, Ed. The Drake equation was done by Frank Drake, I think it was 1965, 68, when the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, at the time, had just ordered a 60-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna. At that time, it was one of the biggest things in the world available. And what Frank Drake did was to talk to the contractor to completing the dish a month ahead of time. And Frank used that time to do a SETI search. The very first SETI search was done in the 60s by Frank Drake himself, and he looked at around the hydrogen line, 14, 20 megacycles, the so-called center of the watering hole, and he looked at adjacent frequencies near a couple of what he thought were good candidate stars to see if there were any unusual signals to be heard. He didn't hear any. But around that time, he came up with the so-called Drake equation, which tries to predict what is the probability that you're going to find an extraterrestrial intelligence. Let me drop. And the equation contains a whole lot of individual variables. How often are stars formed? How long does a star last? How many stars have planets? How many of the planets are in the Goldilocks region where life can form? How many of them are stable for a long enough period of time where life can form? How long is the life expectancy of that life before they destroy themselves? And it goes on and on and on. It adds all of these individual, or multiplies together all of these individual factors, many of which are only known for very wild approximations, and it tries to come up with an approximation of the probability of whether or not you will find extraterrestrial intelligence by whatever search means you're using. How many stars you're looking at simultaneously, how sensitive is your equipment, how wide is the frequency spectrum you're scanning, how narrowband is the scan, can the scan tolerate Doppler shift, and just add variable after variable after variable. Well, one of the variables that used to be in the Drake equation was, at that time, everyone believed that planets going around a star was a rare event. They assumed that most stars were just sitting there by themselves, only a few of them had planets. They used to estimate that once per million stars, you would have a planetary system. And then of those planetary systems, you could estimate what percentage of those had a planet the right size, out of the right materials, in the right region, around that star, and the star is a second or third generation star that has the right raw materials, so that the star is stable enough for a long enough period of time that biological life can form. Very early microbial biological life appeared on this planet, which is what, 4.5 billion years old. It appeared in a fraction of a billion years, but it took a long time for that very simple microbial life to slowly work its way up the evolutionary ladder to start getting to higher plants and animals than you got today. And the so-called intelligent life on this planet, and we think of it as intelligent life, we keep posting our ego by saying that periodically on the job. We've only really been making significant technological progress in the last few hundred years, even though mankind has been around for about a million years. So we're just sort of getting it all together right now. Well, and the main point I'm making about the Drake equation, we used to believe that one star per million had planets. Now that we're discovering so darn many exoplanets, we're discovering with our latest telescope planets going around so many stars, you could say that more than 10% of the stars have planets. We used to think it's 1 in a million, now it's 10%. So however many chunks of life you used to estimate out there with the old-fashioned Drake equation, that estimation has just gone up by 100,000 to 1. 10% versus 1 in a million. So there's 100,000 more chunks of life than the Drake equation used to predict. I think the Drake equation is still good. You just got to bring it up to speed with the more modern numbers as we gather those numbers. That's one way of looking at it, Ed. N2NYW, K2RYW on the tech net.
That's the copy, thank you. Yeah, so, one, you know, but I was thinking about the prime directive. That very well could be true. And it's amazing. You know, sometimes, you know, I went over to Wales with my wife has family over there on the Irish Sea. You know, you look up at night there, no cities even near there. And there were so many stars in the sky. I counted it in about, it was cold, it was chilly. About, I don't know, within about maybe 20 minutes, I counted like 6 meteorites going over. Or meteors, I should say. It was, you know, that's how clear it is. So it makes you wonder. Back to you.
Now, people who live in the metro area today find it very difficult to believe how much flare light, gray light from parkways and everything else, parking lots, storefronts, and whatever we have at nighttime. If you go to a truly rural area, Cherry Valley, I think it's called Astronomical Area in northeastern Pennsylvania. I think it's the Cherry Valley Park, something like that. I keep forgetting the name of it, where quite a few of the members of Astronomical Society of Long Island actually go there periodically. Really dark skies. And the Custer Institute out in Southold, Long Island, they're doing a good job there of trying to maintain local darkness. You go to a truly dark area and wait 20 minutes outside so your eyes become dark and vapid, and you look at the sky, you will not recognize it. You'll see the Milky Way itself literally is made up of something like 100 billion individual stars, and it looks like a great big swash, a blanket, or like a cloud going across the sky. And in a metro area, you would never see that. In a truly dark area, the sky is very different than you would expect. And you go to one of these truly dark areas with an astronomical group, with some good instrumentation, some good telescopes, and you start looking at what there is to be seen, it will give you a very different slant on what astronomy is, what it's capable of doing. And you'll have a little more understanding for why some people get very deep into that hobby, and they add very sensitive electronic cameras to the eyepiece of their telescope and start taking astrophotography. The guys in with the instrumentation they can put in their backyard or in their mobile van these days are capable of making astronomical photographs that Don Palomar would have been very proud of to produce 20 years ago. Guys are doing it with equipment that they can now own. So we're coming along very nicely along these lines. Fun hobby. And that's right, directive. It might very well be in effect. There's a strong possibility we're being observed. Let me drop one more time. I've got a philosophy about this one, and that is we've been humbled 5, 6, 7 times in a row. We used to think the Earth was the center of the universe. It's not. We eventually came to the conclusion the Sun is the center of our solar system. We used to think that was the center. It's not. We used to think our sun is a really significant star. It's just an ordinary one. We used to think it was in the center of our galaxy. It's not. It's 30% of the way from the downtown to the suburbs of this particular galaxy. We used to think our galaxy was something significant. It's not. It's kind of ordinary. We used to think our galaxy is the be-all, end-all. It's not. It's a member of 4 local galaxies. There's a local galactic group. We used to think our galactic group is something significant. It's not. It's just a galactic group among a few million other galactic groups. So, step by step, we've been humbled into thinking that we're the center of everything. We're not. I'm concluding that we're in a very nice position. We got a medium-sized planet, a medium-sized sun, a medium location in our galaxy, a medium-sized galaxy, a medium-sized galactic group, in a medium location of this particular universe. Of all the life that's out there, I think half of it is ahead of us, technologically speaking, and half of it's behind us, which is somewhere in the middle. We weren't favored in any particular way. We're not the head of the pack. We're not the back of the pack. Somewhere in the middle. Some of that life that's out there has had a couple of million or a couple of billion years head start on us. Look what we've done in the last 100 years, just with transistors. In the last 40 years, just with transistors and Moore's Law. Give us a million-year head start, and what could we do? Something pretty significant. A society that does something significant, let me drop, does so because it has curiosity. Most of the breakthroughs that mankind has made is because we're curious. What is Mother Nature telling us? How does the universe work? What is the sun doing? Why does the moon act like that? What are the tides? We're curious. A society that makes technological progress does so because it's curious. Guaranteed, some of the societies out there that have got a million-year or a billion-year head start of us have got curiosity. With that curiosity, they'd like to see what's going on in this little place that where we live. It's a good guess. Guaranteed somebody's curious. Have we been observed? I think the answer is yes. Have we been contacted? Maybe the answer is no. Hang on. The big Q2 in the sky is going to happen someday. And Mel and I are going to start creating the equipment to do that. We're going to listen to Jill Totter and Paul Shuck and all these other guys. We're going to join this search for extraterrestrial intelligence. We're going to join that group of people that are processing those signals on their computers during the computer dead time. And we're going to find these hidden signals. Aren't we, Mel? K2KEY, K2LAW.
Oh, yeah, I could sit and talk to you about hours with this business because when I was there in Ohio, going to school there, of course, you had a lot of people that were really, how can I say, passionate is the right word, and there was a whole thing that was designed about what kind of signal, you know, what would they be communicating, in other words, what would they be sending, what kind of signal, what kind of modulation, and all, and they ruled out that just, you know, CW, and then where they were looking at what they call anti-cryptographic studies, indicating that something else, and how did they would detect the, you know, it was a whole business, I'm telling you. And there was a guy, did you ever hear of a Dr. Paul Horowitz? I just remember him, that he was a professor for a while there. He was originally, I think he went over to Harvard from there, if I'm not mistaken, because I know he was involved with that whole business there and all. I'm trying to recall some of the names. And besides Sean Kraut, there was a Paul, yeah, Dr. Paul Horowitz. And he came up with a whole business on how to, they would, you know, what you, he went through this whole business of how, you know, to search and to what would be required. And it's a monumental task to, you know, to search the universe, even at the so-called frequency that they came up with at the time, that, you know, that watering hole supposedly between what around 1.7 or something big take over.
Yeah, the free hydrogen line at 1420 megacycles. There's more hydrogen in the universe than any other element. And hydrogen all by itself, you could say resonates at 1420 megacycles, a little bit above the 1296 M band. So looking at that frequency, looking at something very close to it, is a good starting point, we used to think. The watering hole, where the atmosphere is reasonably transparent, and you can get great sensitivity, is somewhere a little bit above 1 gig and a little bit below 10 gigahertz. So some people think the watering hole is between 1 and 10 gigs, and one of the key frequencies is the free hydrogen line, 1420 megs. So-called 21 centimeters, and a lot of the radio telescope pictures have been done by Ohio University radio telescope at 21 centimeters by looking at the concentrations of that element throughout the universe. You get a pretty good picture of what's out there, where it is, how far away, how much of it, and so on. And there are other frequencies you can look at. Each individual organic molecule and inorganic molecule, but each individual molecule, each element, each molecule, has a single or a series of resonant frequencies. And you build yourself a good radio telescope, and you look at those frequencies, and every frequency you can imagine, of every element you can imagine, you look at the right place in the universe with a sensitive telescope, and you'll find it. There's lots and lots of organic molecules floating around free in space. The basic building blocks, the amino acids and whatever. They're contained on comets and asteroids and whatever. How did they get there? You and I can speculate. And all of the water that's on this planet, a lot of people in the astronomical world think that that water was deposited by comets and meteors and meteorites striking this planet and depositing their water. So if the basic building material, the raw material that's needed more than anything else, is water, and then hydrocarbons, and you can find those hydrocarbons floating in various combinations in space with the water, that would suggest that the raw ingredients for life is a little bit everywhere, and it's dropping onto individual planets, and if the soil is rich enough and the conditions are right, wait long enough and life will form. There are a lot of people who understand the statistics of large probabilities, I'll drop them, which says that if you have enough material, enough matter, interacting for a long enough period of time, every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. That would lead you to believe that you've got something the size of a planet, and you've got the right raw ingredients, life will form. The Stanley Miller experiment sort of confirmed that. He started off with sterilized oxygen, nitrogen, water, carbon, and a couple of other things. He put them inside of a flask. Nothing happened. He passed an electric spark through the flask for a week study, simulating lightning. At the end of that week, he had what he called primordial soup. He had this brownish-looking goo that when you studied it, it had amino acids. The basic building blocks were there. The suggestion is that if you waited long enough, life would crawl out of that flask. It may take a few million years, but that's what the experiment suggests. So life may not be unique. It could be kind of universal as long as you get the right conditions. So searching for it can be an awful fun thing to do. You'll never find that pink elephant if you don't first make the leap of faith. There could be a pink elephant, and you start looking for one. By the same token, you'll never find extraterrestrial life if you don't start looking for it. It's not going to come and knock on the door and say, here I am. They probably have a prime directive. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Radio check, please. Okay, just give you 1 minute. Well, they want to say our final word. The question was this to Dr. Such at the time. What kind of a transmitter would they be using to contact us? And he figured out that the type of... he says the type of radio communication used by the extraterrestrial would be a binary antenna, I'll never forget this, binary antenna polarization modulation system that we knew of, Dick. I have never seen a system that worked that way. So let's pick up the other station and maybe you can explain what the heck is a binary antenna polarization modulation. And maybe it's a common type of system that was used for maybe extraterrestrial, but that's what he envisioned as the transmitting source running at about 1 gigawatt ERP, I think he said. All right, who's the other station? Go ahead, please.
Well, I guess you answered my question. KB2, YAO, I guess you can hear me. I guess for your response, I was just wanted to know how I might sound, if everything's okay, and I'll let you guys have it back then. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. YAO, you sound pretty good. Tiny bit of a frying noise in the background. Good modulation, and might want to put an antenna on the roof, but whatever you're using is working. Let me drop. If I stood in front of a classroom and whistled continuously a 1 kilohertz note, the student sitting in the room would know I know how to whistle, they know I'm there, and they know how loud I'm whistling. But other than that, I'm not conveying very much useful information. The way you convey useful information on a signaling process is to have something that is to some degree unpredictable. If I modulate that tone with my voice, and you know how to interpret my voice, I can talk to you, and I can give you a lecture. And if you don't know what I'm going to say ahead of time, if it's unpredictable what I'm going to say, and as long as I'm speaking your language, and I'm not speaking above you or below you, information can be conveyed. So the degree of non-predictability is what Shannon's law says is the way to quantify the amount of information you can put on a signal. Now, when it comes to radio and optical signals, you have to modulate the signal in a way that is previously unknown to some degree in order to convey information. Okay? What does modulation mean? you're either changing the amplitude or the phase of the signal. That's about all you can do. You can turn it on and off sinusoidally and transmit a tone on top of the carrier. You can transmit a voice, but you can turn it on and off in amplitude. You can turn it on and off in a digital manner and transmit individual pulses. And you can use pulse position modulation, pulse frequency modulation, pulse duration modulation. But you're using various schemes for adjusting the amplitude versus time. Or you can adjust the phase. It's called angular modulation. I can use phase modulation, frequency modulation. They're closely related to each other. So I can change the frequency in some manner. Once I've generated the signal that has this modulation, supposedly with this intelligence on it, coming up, I now am going to transmit that signal into space. I can transmit it with a horizontal polarized antenna, a vertically polarized antenna, an antenna that's planted at a 45-degree angle. I can transmit it with circular polarization, clockwise, counterclockwise. I can use all of the combinations in between of elliptical polarization with various tilt angles of the major axis and the minor axis of the ellipse of polarization. So, whether I modulate the signal in polarization, amplitude, or phase, these are all techniques of conveying information. I'm taking some parameter of the signaling process, and I'm changing it in a way that your equipment will understand, but yet I'm doing it to a degree that's unpredictable in order to convey useful information. So, is there something magic about modulating the polarization? I don't think so. Is there something magic about modulating the amplitude or modulating the phase? These are all good techniques. But there's nothing magic about any one of them. You're taking a process that's capable of remotely sensing a signal. That's the nice thing about wireless. You transmit some power at point A, and the right kind of receiving apparatus at point B can receive a fraction of that power, and you amplify it. By the way, the average radio receiver that you and I use, on average, has 110 decibels of gain between the antenna and the loudspeaker, or between the antenna and the earphone, or between the antenna and the cathode ray tube, or whatever display device you're using. The average radio receiver has somewhere between 100 and 120 decibels of gain. That's how much the signal gets weaker. One with 11 zeros after it is 110 dB. That's a lot of power difference. Signals get weak pretty fast by the inverse square law, but good modern equipment with a low noise front end is capable of listening to very weak signals. And that signal, once you've established the communication channel and a method of modulating the signal, now you convey information. Paul may think that digital modulation of polarization or analog modulation of polarization is better than something else. Well, any of these polarization modulation techniques, after the signal has reflected off of the floor, the wall, a building, a water tower, a tree, or whatever, the polarization gets kind of scrambled. So polarization as a signaling technique is very difficult to make it pure. Let me drop. Every 10 years or so, starting at around 1940, somebody would come along and say, television broadcast from the Empire State Building, if it was circular polarized instead of linear polarized, horizontal is the one we've used all those years, it would better survive the multiple reflections you get in the marble canyons of New York City and the multipath signals you get that give you fades and everything else out into the suburbs, that if it was circular polarized, it would work better than linear. Every 10 years, somebody came up with a beautiful paper describing, with some fancy mathematics, saying this is going to be great. And the FCC would allocate an experimental frequency. A person would run an experimental transmitter. He would try it, and it was no better. In some cases, it was usually worse, but it was no better. We went through that experiment every single decade, starting around 1940. And those experiments showed that there was no great superiority of circular polarization over linear when it comes to terrestrial communication. When it comes to listening to a satellite, circular has got some great properties that are useful. As long as you've got a direct line of sight to the satellite and no other multipath reflecting object in between. So circular is great for satellites. is terrible for terrestrial. Circular is good, and a lot of people think it's got some kind of mystique to it. There's really no great magic there, in my opinion. I've worked with a lot of antennas that are circular polarized and linear polarized. And there are certain cases where circular is somewhat better. You'd be amazed how many places where it's worse. When it comes to a RFID, radio frequency identification tag reader, circular polarization does put you at a disadvantage. Because once that direct signal between your reader and the tag, combined with the indirect signal bouncing off the floor, combined, your clockwise direct and your counterclockwise reflected indirect combine to become linear. So in the real world of multipath, your great circular polarization is going to be received at the tag as a linear. And if the resultant linear, because of the phase shift between the two, turns out to be vertical, when your tag is horizontal, you ain't talking to that tag. Whereas with linear polarization on the reader, all you've got to do is rotate your wrist a little bit, and you're going to get every one of those tags. And oh, by the way, you get 50% more range out of linear than circular, because the tag is linear, and circular has got half the power horizontal, half the power vertical, so linear tag only sees half the power. You put yourself at a disadvantage with circular. On paper, it sounds great. It makes a great advertisement. There's more flip-flam than reality there. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, yes, this is K2KEY. Yeah, well, as Dr. Fuchs actually told us, I'll never forget it, he said, well, if you look between 1.4 and 1.7 gigs, and that area is that's known as the water hole, he says, then you have a frequency range in there. He says the noise temperature, he says, would be somewhere, I think he says 6 to 8 degrees Kelvin. So he says that if we figured out that if they were using this type of transmitting method, this temperature of 6 to 8 degrees Kelvin would allow a 1 gigawatt EIRP transmitter that's located within 26 light years to be heard with a simple system of receivers. A number of these locked together, antenna systems like he proposed. And he says, we just got to find the frequency. But he says that if they're transmitting that kind of power at that frequency, and within 26 light years, we're going to hear them. Is there anything practical about that stick, or is he just off in another world over?
So that may actually be practical, Mel. As a society advances in its technological progress, it has to its disposal greater and greater sources of raw energy. We're right now using oil as our major source of energy because it is such a concentrated fuel. When all of those plants and animals died and become oil after billions of years of being buried in the ground, you end up with this hydrocarbon substance that has an extremely high watts per pound, it's got the joules per liter, you could say. It's a very dense fuel. You put it in the fuel in the tank of your car, and if it's a real good car, you can drive 400 and some odd miles. You try doing that with batteries or anything else, and boy, it's tough. So it's a very desirable fuel, but there's a finite amount of it. A very rough rule of thumb I came up with one day is that we're burning up 1,000 years of past history every day by the rate at which we're burning up the oil. We ain't going to get away with that forever. We're eventually going to have to go over to wind, solar, tide, every geothermal, every other renewable. The real raw source of all the energy that has ever arrived at this planet of any significance is from the sun. So eventually we're going to go to the horse's mouth. We're going to use solar voltaics, solar-powered wind, solar-powered tide, whatever. We're going to use the energy coming out of the sun. And as we get far enough in technological progress, the amount of energy we can get out of that sun is huge. 1,300 watts per square meter is coming out of that sun at high noon every day. I've got an acre of property. 4.3 million watts of solar energy hit my property at high noon today. 4.3 million watts. If I gathered 1% of that, it would be 43 kilowatts. That's a lot. There's 43 kilowatts being wasted on my property every day. So, and you take places like Germany, which are now subsidizing in a way that's very effective. The real price of electricity in Germany is somewhere around 13 cents a kilowatt hour. They will pay you 50 cents a kilowatt hour for every kilowatt hour you generate on your property and pump back to them. So there are people going along the Autobahn, buying up the land on the perimeter of the Autobahn, putting solar voltaics on it, pumping the energy back to the power company, and collecting the check. As more and more countries do things like that and get smart enough, let me drop. Solar voltaics will become a reality. We'll start gathering more and more energy from the sun. Once we gather enough of it from the sun, to have enough of it to build gigawatt transmitters is easy. And if we suddenly decide that we want to build a gigawatt transmitter, a great big beacon in the sky, saying, here we are. We're joining the society of technologically advanced people. And we start transmitting these pictures and whatever that are easy to decode, saying, here we are, here's how long we've been here, this is what we look like, this is what we care about. We've solved most of our wars. We don't fight with each other as much anymore. Now we're looking for other challenges. In theory, a society could very easily move in that direction. You could calculate how many gigawatts of power they're transmitting, what frequency they're doing at, how big is the antenna, where is it aimed, if it's aimed at us, and we've got a similar antenna aimed at them, over that many light years, can we communicate? The answer is definitely yes. Now, there's a very long delay line between us and them. If they're 4 light years away, which is the closest other star that we know of, it would take 4 years for the message to get from there to here. If they're 1,000 light years away, boy, that's going to be a very slow QSO. But still, it's possible. So, the distance can be covered. Can they send us a message that in their language we will understand? Not an interesting question. But as far as the radio communicating range is concerned, he might be accurate. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, Roger. I'll dig up, maybe we'll get together, maybe go to next month or something. You know, we have to spend our usual night together in June. I'll dig up this thing, some of this stuff. With I got somewhere buried a lot of this stuff. You'd love this stuff, Dick. Dr. Butch. He went on how to design the transmitter, seizures, things. I recall little bits of it every time. But you know, and it was fascinating just to sit and listen to him. If he was there, or if he could do it. Just give me the money, you know, type of thing. And he says, I'll make contact. I'll get you a QSO with another planet. Like you say, it's going to be a long QSO. And getting a QSO card, that's going to be a real project. But or get one of these new electronic QSO cards. All right, maybe we should look at a couple of mailbags here, Dick, because I hate to neglect it. I always promise everybody that we're going to get to the mailbag. So it's 11 o'clock, over.
Yes, we should, Mel. And if there's something else I was going to tell you about what you just said. We'll get to it. Go ahead with question number one.
I just bug him out. He's got a little bottom almost. All right, let me read down a few of them here. Here's one quickie. What the heck is this guy? Oh, my God. Is it one? Where did they come up with this thing? I was in England, and a number of the people there live in these so-called smaller homes, cottages. Yes, they were getting on DVDs and all, and I asked them what kind of antenna. I never saw an antenna like this. And the guy said that if you want this antenna, look into a Bruce, B-R-U-C-E array. Are you familiar with it? I don't know if I've ever heard that. I can't recall off the top of my head. Bruce, B-R-U-C-E, Bruce array. Is that an antenna that you're familiar with? Six, over.
I've heard the name Bruce a number of times. I'm not familiar with it. It sounds to me like a kind of a collineal, I think. Now, if a guy has got a piece of property that's too small, and he wants to work on 80 meters, where a full...